Greetings, friends. It's Chapo coming at you Thursday, October 21st, 2021. We've got me and Matt for you today. Felix is traveling at the moment, but fear not. Our good friend Trevor Strunk is in the house, host of No Cartridge and author of the new Story Mode, video games and the interplay between consoles and culture. Trevor, what's up?
Hey, Will. Not much. How are you?
We're doing good. I will be talking about the book, because for anyone who's interested, the book is essentially annotations for everything Felix has been talking about on the show for the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, you can read the Metal Gear chapter. It'll be very helpful.
What the fuck Felix has been talking about? I highly recommend Story Mode. We will be talking Metal Gear Solid. We'll be talking Fortnite, Doom, Dark Souls, and just what it all means for the culture. But before we get into that, let's talk a little politics. Gentlemen, are you ready to wade into the news stories of the day?
Oh, yeah. Always.
I just want to bring this one up off the top of my show, because I just read it, and it's a headline, New York Times: a 30-year campaign to control drug prices faces yet another failure. Democrats have made giving government the power to negotiate drug prices a central campaign theme for decades. With the power to make it happen, they may fall short yet again.
God damn it.
Oh.
It's probably because we didn't donate enough. I keep getting those emails, and I'm just...
Oh my God, you're right. Trevor, I got a text message last night, and they were like, we're just $15 short of allowing Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices. Please, can you kick in?
You left it on red.
This. I was like, I got to watch Squid Game. Oh, fuck. All right. Well, I mean, this is by Jonathan Wiseman of The Times, and it's just seeming to look into the idea of, like, the Democrats have, you know, they've been campaigning on this issue for 30 years. Now they control the government. But they're going to flub it. As he says, they're going to flub it once again. And I want to know why. Why is the case? It would seem to be a win-win for them to get this passed. But the article begins, when a powerful Democratic Senate chairman assembled his special committee on aging to confront what he called a crisis of affordability for prescription drugs, he proposed a novel solution: allow the government to negotiate better deals for critical medications. The year was 1989, and the idea from that chairman, former Senator David Pryor of Arkansas, touched off a drive for government drug price negotiations that has been embraced by two generations of Democrats and one Republican president, Donald J. Trump, but now appears at risk of being left out of a sprawling domestic policy bill taking place in Congress. I mean, is it fair to describe the bill as it currently stands as sprawling?
It's sprawling all over the place. It's man-spreading is what it's doing.
It's kind of sprawling in the way that you would describe, like, a development or a subdivision is sprawling. Like, you keep turning and you get lost because all the streets look the same, but it's really just like, you know, like an acre.
a lot of cul-de-sacs.
Yeah, of cul-de-sacs. Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Senior Democrats insist that they have not given up the push to grant Medicare broad powers to negotiate lower drug prices as part of a once ambitious climate change and social safety net bill that is slowly shrinking in scope. They know that the loss of the provision promoted by President Biden on the campaign trail and in the White House could be a particularly embarrassing defeat for the package, since it has been central to Democratic congressional campaigns for nearly three decades. Guys, If they don't get this prescription drug thing in this bill, it's going to be so embarrassing for the Democrats. Would not want to be in their shoes right now. I mean, how do you think they're going to deal with the embarrassment?
They're definitely going to, in their next batch of ads for the midterms, they're going to come clean and be like, look, we have no intention of lowering prescription drug prices. They're going to finally have to come clean with people.
I think they're going to finally say that, you know, we have a lot of these ideas. There are policies, but we have these lobbyists in our ears. It's really important that we get our money for our campaigns. You know, it's so hard for Joe Manchin to do this if he's not, like, you know, also supposed to run for reelection in never. So, like, you know, that's probably going to be how they handle it, I think. Transparency.
So it says here, it's not dead, declared Representative Richard E. Neal of Massachusetts, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. You might remember Chairman Richard E. Neal from retaining his seat on the House Ways and Means Committee and winning the election by essentially lying. but essentially, I don't know, what do you call it? Like a chicken hawk shaming Richard Morris by attempting to imply that him asking to get drinks with a 30-year-old represented some sort of grooming habit on his behalf as an openly gay man.
Yeah. Also a top top recipient of pharmaceutical company donations in Congress.
It says here, after so many campaign trail promises, Democrats could be left next year with a lot of a lot of explaining to do, Democrats. It would mean that the pharmaceutical industry, which has 1,500 paid lobbyists, the pharmaceutical industry, which has made $50 billion in profits last year, the pharmaceutical industry, which pays its executive huge compensation packages and which is spending hundreds of millions of dollars to defeat this legislation, will have won. Senator Bernie Sanders, the Vermont Independent and Budget Committee chairman, said on Wednesday. And I intend not to allow that to happen. Bernie, I love you, buddy, but it does seem to me, by like giving quotes like this to the New York Times, it does seem to me like and also like being in charge of shepherding this awful bill, it does seem to me like he is, for one reason or another, playing a role for the Democratic Party, which is to give people the impression that they really want this bill to pass.
He has been buck broken. That's all there is to it. And why not? I mean, it's he got his ass kicked. He got murked by a party that is still able to unite against a left threat in a way it can't do to anything else. And he's 80 years old in the Senate. I guess he wants to go out feeling like he helps somebody afford medicine or something. And that's nice, but that's nice for him. I don't really blame him for it. But at the same time, I'm not going to get too invested in any of this congressional drama, because we know who runs the party. They showed it. They showed what they were willing to do to keep control of it. And there's no reason to believe they're going to change their approach to legislation now, especially since with Trump still around, they will be able to fundraise and gather votes for eternity as the backstop against civilizational destruction, as the only alternative to fascism. They don't have to actually deliver anything if that's what they're there to do.
Jonathan Wiseman on Twitter, sharing his own article, says, Democrats appear ready to fumble the ball at the goal line. Failure would be akin to the GOP's flubbing a repeal of Obamacare after so many promises. And it's like, I wonder, can Jonathan Wiseman put two and two together in his head? Because like, it is very identical to the GOP's failure to repeal Obamacare, in that they didn't want to repeal Obamacare. And the Democrats don't want to negotiate lower prescription drug prices. To proponents, defeat after defeat speaks solely to the power of the pharmaceutical industry and its attendant lobbyists. But opponents say it reflects the complexity of the issue. Advanced countries with fixed government purchase prices have seen access to medicines constrained either by drug companies or by governments that choose their preferred medications. That could lead to a repeat of the political problems faced after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, when President Barack Obama's promise that if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor proved to be untrue. Medicare recipients could find prescriptions that they have long taken suddenly unavailable. If anyone thinks that this is an easy political route for me, that's just laughable, said Mr. Peters, who endured scorn and pressure from his Democratic colleagues, but whose San Diego district includes almost 1,000 biotechnology companies and 68,000 jobs directly tied to pharmaceutical work. Mr. Schrader and Mr. Peters said the House version of prescription drug price controls, tucked into the broader social policy legislation, would stifle innovation in one of the country's most profitable global industries. So as you see here, it's... I mean, he's bearing a big political price for this, you know, because, I mean, he can continue to be a congressman because the people who give him money to be a congressman will he won't anger them. But his voters, who are also work for the pharmaceutical industry, will be mad at him as well.
And even if they didn't, what is some insurgent going to say? Oh, he voted against X, Y, and Z in what? A bunch of fucking pamphlets they mail to people's houses, or of a commercial that like only goes on YouTube or something. Meanwhile, he's able to just throw that bankroll out there to remind people of how he's fighting for working class families. And everybody goes, oh, yeah, I recognize him. I voted for him last time. And then they just do again.
Yeah. I mean, and like the funny thing about like what Bernie said and what Bernie said there is like this idea of like the complex issue, or like what we'd say if like, you know, oh, you know, if we let this happen and the pharmaceutical companies have won. Like, it's just such a dodge where like the idea becomes like, yeah, okay, we'll make it obvious that on some level, we're not already living in like a corporate state, right? Like the idea that the pharmaceutical company would be able to veto this bill, like at any point, is only fictional for people who like hear that and say like, oh, this isn't just theater. This is like, these people are being very, very serious about how hard this is for them. And like, what, you know, how many nights they're staying up thinking like, how can I balance the need of the corporate with the need of my poor, you know, the constituents. Like it feels like more than any time really that I can remember democratic politics, it feels like absolute theater. And they know it's absolute theater, and the people who are reading it know it's absolute theater.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Like, Jonathan Wiseman seems to be the only one who doesn't know this theater, but I mean, that's why he works for the political press and not the business press.
Yeah. You have to be this tall and under to work for the political press, basically. Like,
no, they, it's like, it's just like with cops. Like, if you do too well on the intelligence test, you can't get the job.
I mean, yeah, like, I mean, I could go further in this article, but like, I mean, there's really no point though. I mean, it just seems to be whether it's this infrastructure or social infrastructure or budget bill. I mean, it just, it doesn't seem like there's really anything in there that's worth voting for at all. So like, I mean, I don't know, like if you're Bernie or whatever, just let this one die.
Yeah.
Like, I just, there's nothing there worth doing. And it, like, even if like, it'll fill a few potholes or whatever. Like, is it worth getting tagged for what will eventually like be the case, which is just like another Obamacare, which takes like our already like threadbare, meager fucking welfare state, or like whatever services that are like provided by the government will just become ever more complex and annoying to deal with.
Well, Democrats are obsessed with this idea of like, I don't know how, I mean, I know that Will, you're a big time Yankees fan.
Number one,
you love the Yanks,
the captain, Jeter,
and I know that Matt, you follow Wisconsin sports like no one else. There's this idea in sports where you can kind of kick the can down the road, right? Like you sign someone really expensive, and then your budget's messed up, and you're like, well, okay, but my budget will be messed up in 2026, right? Like I'll kick the can down the road and win this year. And the Democrats have been obsessed with this like this concept just backwards, where they kick the can in the current year. And then they say, like, 2 years down the road, we're going to be great. Like, I don't know if I've ever said this on the podcast or not, but my dad ran for state representative in 1992, PA. And he ran with a $1,500 budget, probably further left than anyone wanted to vote for at that time, even though he's, you know, up until recently, he's been a fairly bog standard Democrat, and got closer than anyone else has to winning the race against Ray Bunt, the current incumbent. And the PA Democratic Party says, yeah, you know, they invite him down and they say like, okay, you're going to lose this race. But what we want you to do is lose this race so you can win a race down the road in 2 years. And my father, intelligent man that he is, decided that sounded stupid and dropped out of politics. But like, I mean, that's the Democratic Party though. That's 1992 and it's 2021. At the same time, it's, you know, we will lose today to win tomorrow. But then when tomorrow comes, we lose again.
It's been three decades of a rebuilding year for the Democratic Party. but yeah, I mean, like, not much more to talk about that article. It's just on my head. It's like the perfect representation of where everything is in our politics. Joe Biden is getting nothing done, but the thing is, he doesn't even want to.
The thing is that it doesn't matter if anyone wants it or not, because there is no party preference other than keeping out the left, which is because that actually it lights up everybody within the structure's instincts in the same direction and organizes their preferences around one goal. Without that, there is no disciplining any individual member of honestly either caucus. The parties have dissolved as meaningful containers of ideology or agenda of any kind. All you have are 535 individual political entrepreneurs who are operating off of their own specific short-term interests, self-conceived interests, mostly in order to like get a fucking OnlyFans or something out of it, or a lobbying gig or something, and with no institutional investment whatsoever. Like, this bill would be very good for Democrats to pass, and all that stuff. Like, you might lose money from the pharmaceutical industry if you did cut prescription drug prices significantly, but you would also presumably be able to benefit at the polls for doing that. But there can be no, given the current structure of the parties, there can be no long-term, even medium-term planning strategy or action. There is only the short-term best self-interest of the individual members of Congress. And if that's the only presiding, orienting agenda, then nothing will get done. Nothing can get done.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's just sounds like a broken record again on this show, but just like that article, it's astonishing to me that anyone still pretends that the Democrats want to lower prescription drug prices, or like
That's the thing, is that there's no want, there's no Democrats, you know, like there is no institutional agenda, like that there is that doesn't exist. Like, that is the greater fraud. It's not even the fraud of, like, pretending that they have specific desires. It's pretending that they actually have any desires at all. That's the fraud. But without that lie, without that assumed fantasy to operate from, it's almost impossible to write political journalism that adheres to a narrative of ideology and doesn't just talk about vested interests and money, which... the whole point of the political journalistic genre is to elide that fact and to find something else to talk about.
Well, you essentially have like lobbyists on top of lobbyists there, right? Like, because like if Jonathan Weisman burned everyone by saying like, yeah, it's all about money, like you know, the Nancy Pelosi has how much money at this point, and that doesn't come from voting against her corporate interests, Jonathan Weisman would lose all his contacts, right? Like, Jonathan Weisman would not be able to be a political reporter anymore. Would have to report from the outside.
But also, if everybody did that, they would also lose their audience, because that's boring to watch. Yeah. That's not why people pay attention to political news. They want the story. They want the villains and the heroes.
Fanfic, yeah.
They want the narrative. They want to feel like they're on the inside of a house of cards. They don't want to be told that these decisions are all made in corporate boardrooms. It's fucking boring. Like, okay. Everybody's incentive, the audience for this and the people who make up the press, is to maintain this kayfabe.
Given that that's the case, and that people want an exciting narrative, they want heroes and villains, and they want to essentially live in another form of virtual reality. That's right. I'm talking about video games. Let's talk about something fun and interesting, and not more of the same political bullshit. Trevor just wrote a book about video games, and I'd like to start out by talking about another New York Times article that is related to video games. Assassin's Creed has a new mission: working in the classroom. History has long served as a backdrop in the Assassin's Creed video games, whose storylines center on pivotal times in history, from the Third Crusade to Imperial China and beyond. But when players of this Ubisoft series rush from mission to mission as agents of events both great and small, their purpose is rarely to take time to appreciate history itself. Duty always calls. Until now. Following last year's release of Assassin's Creed Origins, set in Ptolemaic Egypt, the team behind it decided that allowing players to learn more about life in ancient Egypt might make for a pretty cool teaching aid. So they traded the quests and violence for antiquities and history lessons and created a mode with a series of discovery tours. By putting history front and center, the game may give teachers a new way to connect with some students. So have we finally caught up to the Simpsons joke about, Lisa, you'll be, I'm Genghis Khan, you'll eat who I eat, defile who I defile.
I'm just really glad that public schools are finally going to be talking about the eternal war between the Templars and the Assassins.
Yeah, no, it's
that
important.
It defines all world history.
I think it's nice that kids are going to have to grapple with Ubisoft's completely illogical and crazy idea to keep that the frame story about like the virtual reality machine in there. Like, I think that's good. I think it's like in an English class, you can ask who thought this was a good idea. Like, why aren't we just following the Assassins? And kids are going to have to answer that. And that's important. Like, Ubisoft gives a lot just from one small seed.
So, I mean, is the framing device, I mean, so that this centuries long battle between Templars and Assassins, is that essentially what the Assassin's Creed games are about?
It's literally what they're about. Yeah, Matt hit it on the head. Yeah, it's like it's all it's about. You play as the Assassins and you fight against the Templars. I mean, in fair, so like the one thing to say about the Assassin's Creed games is they do paint a sort of like fun, immersive historical vision, which is like the thing anyone will say is fun about them, right? When they go bad, they're bad because that doesn't work. When they're good, like in Assassin's Creed 2, when it's in Italy, it's really fun because it feels like, okay, like I'm here with the Medicis and like the Borgias and stuff like that. Like this is really the Warring States period or whatever. But yeah, I mean, at the backdrop, it's all just assassins versus Templars, which I mean is what the history is based on.
What are their goals? I mean, this basically just sounds like a ripoff of the Illuminatus trilogy.
I mean, it is. It's pure Dan Brown, right? Like it's just like this is just, you know, the assassins are on the side of good and the Templars are on the side of evil. You know, the assassins want to, you know, if you want to know the plot of any Ubisoft game, just imagine the most sort of bland liberal ideology that you can, and that's the plot of the Ubisoft game, where like the bad guys are going to be against the spread of information, the good guys are going to be for the spread of information within certain bounds. And so the assassins have a pretty good idea of what they want. The Templars don't want anyone to know the real history of things, and so you fight them through time. But like, I don't know, like the point of the Assassin's Creed games has always been like, yeah, you get to be in these wonderful, it's the old Navy bumper sticker you used to see, like go to exotic places and kill everyone in them. Like it's, you know, that's the whole point. It's completely sadistic.
Do you ever smoke weed hash before going out to merc people?
No.
Do you get sucked off in the garden in Ismail Hassan's garden?
I mean, maybe you get sucked off in the later ones. I don't know, the Viking one, you might get sucked off. I could see it. I like, so the thing about the Assassin's Creed games too is like they're absolutely focused on the Ubisoft model, which is like Ubisoft makes games where it's just a Skinner box. And I mean, most games are, but like there's so much a Skinner box where like you basically go from tower to tower and open up the map. And then within the map, there's little missions and you go do those missions. And then like, you know, you get little dopamine hits as you do it and you get little currency points. So your assassin's better, right? That seems to be like an openly terrible way to teach history, to be like go to all these waypoints and like figure out what it is, like open up the map and figure out who Leonardo da Vinci is. Not to mention that like you run into Karl Marx in like one of them and he's like, hey,
is he on the side of the assassins or the Templars though?
That's a good question. I think he's sort of like he's like Leonardo da Vinci in that like he's also in the games, in that he sort of he kind of exists.
He's also
in the
a video
shadows
game
and
character.
You help him.
Yeah.
You help these great men through history to keep their things going on. And Karl Marx eventually just like kind of decides that maybe he's being a little too extreme, right? so like, yeah, no, it's like it absolutely is. Like it's just, you know, you're an assassin, you help these great men through history, and you keep unlocking stuff. It like it is every bad impulse in historicism. That you could possibly want just like in a video game.
Well, you say that.
I don't know if you could like unlock skins of different historical figures for your avatar to wear. That could be educational.
Yeah. No, I would say like, you know, what you got to do is like, if you want to teach about Egyptian history, you get Ramses II in Fortnite. And at that point, like then people are going to be invested in learning about it. Like you have to read like 7 articles to get the Ramses skin. Like kids are going to do that.
You're going to have to do a lot of farming to build one of those pyramids. That's all I got to say. But I mean, like you say it, this is bad history, but like, I'm just glad students at any age will be exposed to the idea that nothing is true. Everything is permitted.
I love that. Like at the core of the Assassin's Creed games is this like Levian Satanism. Like it's just like the left-hand path for like teens. Very good stuff. Like I hope this like this ushers in a whole new level of like blood and sex magic in our schools. Just like
also that. Sugar. Let's throw some sugar in there.
Look, I mean,
but let's do it under a bridge.
If we're gonna go all ketis, we might as well.
Yeah.
They talked to a middle school teacher at Intermediate School 230 in Jackson Heights, Queens, who said there could be tremendous value in it for both students and educators, particularly for students who might test as primary visual, auditory, or kinesthetic learners. For those students, she added, exposing them to a different learning vehicle is always beneficial. She also said she understands the importance of games to her students and has even used Oregon Trail as a teaching tool. Now, gentlemen, I know we're all about the same age. Did you remember playing Oregon Trail in school?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Okay, did you learn anything from it?
Learned dysentery was a big problem.
I learned that everyone died of shitting
themselves.
I learned
it's very easy to shoot buffalo. I will say that that is actual, like, when you when they try to explain, like, how the, quote, West was won and how the Plains Indians were subdued, the ease of murdering a buffalo was key to that. Like, you got people who could just shoot them on the back of moving trains and stuff. So I did learn that it is incredibly easy to kill a buffalo. Mm-hmm. Very hard to kill a squirrel. Very easy to kill a buffalo.
It's also very tempting to take your whole family across, like, the vast wasteland of the American West and, like, not look back. Like, you know, that's the one thing I learned is why all those people died. Because once you're in, you're like, well, I'm in. Like, I'm not going to go back. This is a sunk cost. You know, I'm like, I bought how many axles?
And every single person who tried to ford a river died. That's one thing I know.
No, don't
That's
do
why
it.
They yeah. started building bridges, is because literally everyone who ever tried to ford a river drowned.
People just put the cart on and pushed it across.
I mean, I guess I remember another, like, I guess a semi-historically accurate feature of Oregon Trail is in the hunting mode, Matt, like you were saying, where you could just, like, blow away a buffalo. You could keep doing it until you killed, like, 50 buffalo, and they'd be like, you could only take, like, a couple hundred pounds of meat back to the back to the trail, and then you just leave a wasteland of fucking wasteland, which is how we converted I think at the time the single largest biomass on the planet, which is the Plains American bison, into, like, by the beginning of the 20th century, almost totally extinct.
That's American excellence.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, yeah. So video games are teaching kids about famous historical assassinations and how, you know, the secret levers that move history, which are the Knights Templar and the Illuminati. But
it's amazing thought. Like you're going to teach kids that it's like it's canon now that, like, you know, various popes were killed by assassins. Because, like, in Assassin's Creed 2, you kill a pope, like, or a cardinal at least. Like,
hell yeah.
That's like. I feel like the back door into people being, like, obsessed with stuff like QAnon is not, you know, like, oh, I saw a video by Ben Shapiro. It's like playing a game like Assassin's Creed and being like, is this all true? Like, is this all right? Just encouraging that seems like a risky plan.
Well, moving on from the classroom to the book itself. I mean, let's talk about another major area, like, you know, a major zone of learning in which our kids are now learning. I'm talking about Fortnite. Trevor, you write in the introduction of the book, you bring up an article you wrote in the outline titled Fortnite Could Only Exist in a World That's Running Out of Resources. Could you elaborate on how Fortnite puts the lie to the idea of a post scarcity society, and also how do you connect Fortnite to the sort of experimental English novel Tristram Shandy?
Oh, well, okay, I don't remember exactly how I do it, but I can do it again. So, like, you know, I got a lot of flack for this article when I wrote it, probably because it was out of the outline, where a lot of weird stuff came out of. RIP to the outline, I suppose. You know, like, one of the things I meant to say about it is, like, we have this massive, like, outpour of these battle royale games where, like, literally you're dropped on a map with 100 other people. Your job is to be the last one standing or the last team standing in the case of, like, something like Apex Legends. And as time goes on, you have to collect resources in order to be able to survive, and the map closes in on you as natural disasters wipe out the rest of the map, or government interference in the case of, you know, whatever other games, wipe out the map. So, like, you know, in Fortnite, it's the storm. You have to keep going in to avoid the storm. In PUBG, PlayerUnknown's Battleground, you have to keep moving in because there's this blue taser material that will kill you if you stay outside of the circle. And ultimately, there's, like, one spot for one person to be in, and you kill everyone else in order to live there. Now, people said I was reading too much into it. I think that's pretty obviously something that is born out of, like, maybe in the sort of, like, you know, the classical subconscious of, you know, common subconscious or whatever, collective unconscious, sorry, where, like, you know, like, everyone is worried about being the last person standing and having to, like, you know, scrounge when their tasties aren't at the supermarket or whatever. And these games just seem to be, like, obsessed with this, right? Like there's nothing more to our current moment and to our current moment in the last, like, 10 years, worrying about climate change, worrying about supply chains, worrying about, like, now with the pandemic, worrying about that, like, dropping on a map, chopping up something, gathering wood, and building a little hovel for ourselves so someone can't shoot us, right? So, I mean, that was basically where I was going with Fortnite. Like, it really is like it's a post-scarcity game, right? Like, it's a game that is like obsessed with this idea of there's not enough stuff, which, as we know, is like is not true. Like, there's plenty of stuff. It's actually getting it to places. That's the problem.
It's also building a giant deck very quickly, from what I understand. Does anyone play Fortnite anymore?
I don't know. I wrote that article.
I know Felix doesn't.
I think it's still quite popular. It keeps releasing. So I keep getting stuff from Epic Games that tells me about the new Fortnite stuff. And it's like, let me see if I can pull it up. Like, the one was like Fortnite Nightmares, where there was like this like Devil Queen in Fortnite now. Or like, I know they had the one Ryan Reynolds character from that movie, Free Guy, was a character in Fortnite.
They just did a Dune Fortnite. Dune is available on Fortnite. There are sandworms in the game now. You can play Paul Atreides.
They love spending money over there. I mean, Tencent loves spending money.
And then also the Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech. That was also in Fortnite. Well, so you could attend.
Talk about teaching history to our kids.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But like you could experience these moments in history, but not as a Templar, not as an assassin or a Templar. You can experience it as, let's say, Rick from Rick and Morty or the Xenomorph from Alien.
Yeah, that's important. I mean, I think one of the things that's keeping us from really understanding the importance of the civil rights era is the fact that we can't picture Rick as part of it. You know, like, we see him as a separate from it. And if we were watching Rick and Morty, understanding he went through the 60s and had a position on Martin Luther King, I think that would be much more powerful.
But back to
Tristram Shandy,
confounding an satirical experimental novel, Tristram Shandy. Trevor, speak on Tristram Shandy and how it relates to Fortnite.
So one of the things that I did in the book, and I always say, like, my agent and my publisher were probably like really mad at me for this, but one of the things I did in the book was I tied the history of video games, or like the sort of incipience of video games, to the history of the novel. And like, part of this, actually, I have to credit to you, Matt. Like, one of the things that was most challenging to me has always been your critique of video games, right? Like, as like these sort of like pointless, you know, bread and circus kind of things, right? Which, like, in a lot of ways they are. Like, you're not wrong. But there's also this like level at which like the incipience of video games as a medium mirrors like the way that the novel came about, because you have a bunch of people looking at these things and saying, like, these are deviant like objects, like, people shouldn't be looking at them. They should be reading, in the case of video games, they should be reading novels instead. Or in the case of novels, they should be reading poetry instead. It's the same with like photography, right? Like, people see that when photography first came out, people were like, well, this will never be art. Right. Because it's just like, it's just a representation of the world. There's no interpretation. Same with film. Like, it's not even a claim. It's just like a historical fact. Like, when new mediums come out, you get these sort of like tensions with people who appreciated the old mediums and don't see a way that the new medium can kind of exist. And so, daringly, my book does not make a claim about whether or not video games will ever be art. But it does. It has some bravery in that it says, video games are in the position that novels once were, right? Where, like, Tristram Shandy, Tom Jones, I don't know, has anyone in the chat read Tom Jones? Has anyone done the reading this week?
I've seen the movie with Albert Finney.
Okay, good. Yeah, it's pretty good. It's a weird book, man. Like, it's fun, but every section starts with this, it's basically Henry Fielding, the author, spending, I don't know, like, 3,000 words saying, like, I promise you this is a cool thing I'm writing. Like, what I'm writing is, like, it's a poem, but it's a novel, but it's a book, but it's a story, but it's a journal article. Like, I promise it's going to be really cool. And every time he just, like, it's basically like someone who you see on Twitter constantly saying, like, yeah, you know, like, I promise this is getting somewhere, guys. I know that this is weird, but it's going to be cool. He has that at the beginning of every one. And Shandy's the same way, except Tristram Shandy's much more, Lawrence Stern is much more confident. And neither really look like novels as we'd expect them to look, but they're both sort of the first versions of it.
But in Tristram Shandy, there's kind of like a hypertext to it as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like an early form of like hypertext.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, Tristram Shandy is a version of like what we can see if we look kind of like, if we squint, right, at current video games. One of the things I was thinking about, so like to explain Tristram Shandy first, like, Tristram Shandy, for anyone who hasn't read it, is like an absolutely brilliant book. I think it's actually pretty legible to current audiences, but I can understand why people aren't super interested in it. It's like 600 pages long, but it's a story about it's the story about how Tristram Shandy was supposed to be the story of Tristram Shandy's life. But the joke of the book is that you never actually get to the point of Tristram Shandy's conception. He keeps trying to describe when his father knocked up his mom and never gets to it. He can't get to it. And like to the point where like he's saying like, yeah, you know, she was probably distracted when he shot it in like and that made me weird. Like that kind of stuff happens, but it never gets there. So it's this history that never starts. Right. It's very meta that way.
Like the first 9 seasons of How I Met Your Mother.
There you go. Yep. It is, you know, it's sort of a vulgar version of How I Met Your Mother. I think that's a really good way of looking at it. Yeah. But like video games, I was thinking about it when we were talking about Assassin's Creed. Like there's this video game that's really interesting called Cart Life, which is about, it's a free game if anyone wants to play it, but it's about basically having a food cart and like trying to survive. And the whole game is about how like deeply impossible it is to survive and like make your living based on the food cart. It's basically a game about failing. And what's so interesting about Cart Life is the same thing that's interesting about Tristram Shandy in that like they're both emergent texts. What's actually interesting about them is probably not going to be appreciated by like the people who are reading them at the time. Like no one is going out to play a AAA game is going to like enjoy playing Cart Life, right? Like it's not super interesting. Or like Outer Wilds, another game where like the exploration and the sort of unwrapping of the thing is the interesting part. That's never going to be as popular as something like Assassin's Creed, which gives you instructions. In the same way, it's not going to be as popular as Tom Jones, which gives you a roadmap, or Clarissa, which also like it's a series of letters. Samuel Richardson writes a series of letters. Yeah. Damn it. but yeah, no, like it is like Shandy in a lot of ways represents the sort of promise for video games in that like it is an emergent text. There's something going on there. There's an awareness of the medium, right? And like that actual awareness of the medium is what I find so interesting about current video games, that like they've been around long enough that there's a series of expectations and norms, that exist within the genre that people can either replicate or satirize or write against or comment upon.
I mean, just like back to Fortnite for a second. I mean, you talked about like this post-scarcity world where it's just like it's the most popular game among kids, and it's just like you're all dropped onto an island and you basically kill each other until there's one person left. And,
yeah.
and the people you're killing are, you know, they could be bots, they could be just someone across the world, but a lot of times they're your friends too. You want to kill your friends or team up with your friends to kill other people. Obviously, this is, I mean, like, just like in recent culture, this is the plot of Squid Game. Squid Game is essentially Fortnite, the TV show, and now the most popular streaming show of all time. But, are these texts? I mean, Squid Game is, of course, it's sort of a subversive narrative. But like, are these texts in some way preparing this current generation for a future of scavenging and killing their friends to survive?
Yeah, super interesting. Because like, you know, I feel on some level that is the anxiety beyond. Sorry to sound so academic, but it's like the anxiety behind their production, right? You know, something that exists where like you create something like Squid Game, or you create something like Fortnite in the back of your mind because you're thinking to yourself, wow, like in the future, this is going to be something where people are fighting for resources. Like the sort of like urtext in some ways of these battle royale games is either Lord of the Flies or the movie and manga Battle Royale, which is just that, the concept. It's the Hunger Games before the Hunger Games, right? But like, I'm not so sure that they actually serve as educational texts so much as they serve as like these demonstrations of how we can take the lessons of like an anti-capitalist or an anti-consumerist text and turn them into, you know, rules for living our lives as a capitalist or a consumerist. Like, so like, I don't know if you saw that tweet where it was like the Ethereum guy, or it was some sort of crypto guy, saying like, yeah, Squid Game made $900, you know, $1 million or whatever. But if you invested, you know, $1,000 of Bitcoin in 1998, you would have made more. And like, there, it's not like that isn't lost on the audience, right? Like the audience, when they're watching Squid Game, like a lot of people are trying to figure out how they could win that game. Or like there's an anime and a manga called Kaiji that's about a guy who is like stuck in this horrible cycle of trying to like gamble for his life. And like one of the ways people love reading Kaiji is asking like, well, how can Kaiji win, right? And the point of any of these texts should never be like, how do you win? It's the fact that like, if Squid Game is to be understood as a subversive text, the point is that you can't win, right? Like, it is an unwinnable situation unless you like reject the concept. But inevitably, like in Fortnite, like in Squid Game, we ultimately sort of look at the concept and say like, oh, here's how I could game the concept to win in this situation. Like, I think ultimately these are written with an anxiety about like in a post-capitalist future, but are always read with the understanding that it's a way to kind of succeed in a capitalist reality.
Well, when you're talking about, I mean, in comparing the video game to the novel, or like, you know, like emerging narrative forms, whether it's like the novel, the movie, and now video games, each has come with this attendant sort of moral panic about it leading to violence. I mean, who can forget the spate of suicides that rocked Europe after The Sorrows of Young Werther was published?
It's true. They totally blame Goethe for those suicides. Like, I don't know. Like, I would worry if my kid was picking up some Goethe. Like, I hope he's reading about the optics and not
Werther. Keep your children away from German romanticism.
A lesson that rings true even today.
Well, I mean, I want to get into your chapter on first-person shooters, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, like, I mean, for our generation, it was Doom. It was Doom 2. That was it. That was, like, you could play it on your home computer, just the keyboard, just the shotgun, the Gatling gun, the chainsaw. You're just tearing through these fucking demons. It was, like, you know, it was grisly, violent, gory. It was the game that parents were concerned about.
They hated
And then Columbine happened, and they were like, oh, like they were... These are murder simulators that are just training sociopaths to, like, you know, enact out in reality these violent mass murder fantasies.
Right.
How do we go from like the panic over Doom 2 to now like franchises like Call of Duty, which are almost like, I don't know, like state approved in a way?
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
one of the things that I find so interesting about that, like, that was my favorite chapter to write, because there is this, like, I thought I had a hypothesis about how the chapter would go. And then when I did the research, like, it was borne out more than I could have hoped. Like, the Columbine thing was not the moment it turned, basically. It really was like 9/11 where things like shifted for first person shooters. But like, Columbine was like a big deal for first person shooters, as you say, like, not just because they like resembled it, but because, like, you know, Eric Harris made Columbine levels. Like, they're can still get them. Like, they're you know, they're sort of like on the hidden parts of the internet or whatever, but like, not really. Like, you can just download his maps. They're not even interesting. Like, this I felt again like Matt Chrisman reading this, where like I was like, these are like not even exceptional maps. Like, these are just like normal Doom maps that this mass murderer made. Like, what does that tell us about the genre, right? But like, after 9/11, we get, very soon after 9/11, we get Call of Duty, we get Medal of Honor, we get Battlefield, all genre, all like these massive tentpole games. And some of them are right before 9/11 too. Like, I think Medal of Honor is 2000. But right around there, we get these tentpole military shooter games, as well as these, a little later, we get America's Army. Right. And America's Army is like the perfect example of this for me. Like, I don't know if you guys remember America's Army.
This is the video game that was literally created by the Defense Department.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's an interview that Polygon does with the guy who made it. And they're like, wow. So like, what do you think about this? Is this for recruiting? And he's like, well, I guess like we want to let people know what the Army's all about. And they'll be like, well, don't like, is it? Do you bring in the horror of war? And he's like, well, you know, more or less, it's fine. But they're all about, like, it's basically just a bunch of West Point people who majored in marketing brought together to make a video game that makes recruiting more palatable. And you'd think, right, like, oh, if you know, the sort of like naive opinion here would be like, well, certainly if we're making more realistic shooters where people are more, but people, not just demons, people are more realistically like gutted, killed, torn apart. Like, in the most recent Call of Duty multiplayer, there's a white phosphorus ultimate. Like, it's like, you know, like, you can like drop white phosphorus on people. And as I say in the book, like, the main complaint is from Call of Duty players who are like, this isn't in the meta. Like, this isn't interesting. Like, you can't use the white phosphorus effectively in multiplayer. No one cares. Like, literally, like, the Penny Arcade guys made fun of people who cared about America's Army being like propaganda. People are like, you know what? It's cool.
Because, like, you know, if you have on one hand, like, the idea that, like, it's absurd that Doom 2 led to Columbine. Like, you can't get too concerned about the idea that Call of Duty will lead to, you know, a spike in military recruitment either. Because it's,
yes,
like, it's
totally.
These violent fantasies, like, there's never, like, you have to choose. It's either all or nothing, whether you believe it's, like, a one-to-one fucking transfer from, like, the virtual to the real world.
Yeah, I think the thing about, so, like, the reason I focus on America's Army so much is, like, America's Army actually is this moment where people are, like, hey, look, we'll give this to you for free. Like, the game was free. And they say, like, be sure to think about the army when you play this, right? Like, that is, like, that's a very clear sort of, like, consent manufacturing, right? Where it's, like, the only time the violence is okay is if it's American soldiers doing it. Which is how you get, like, the more and more, like, the bigger and bigger intensification of the violence. I think, like, there is a distinction where, like, the old first-person shooters are these, like, you know, like, weird fantasy violence, right? Where, like, I guess, like, I don't think anyone's going to play Call of Duty and want to kill Iraqis, right? Like, I don't think that's true. But I do think that there is an understanding of these games as recruitment simulators that people celebrate, right? Instead of saying, like, that's kind of fucked up. Like, don't make people go kill humans. It's more like, okay, well, that's important. We need soldiers, right? So, like, let's use these to glorify soldiers. And you get, like, people like, you know, like, those weird Christian media critique people on board with it too. And at that point you get a shift, right, from, like, these are outsider games to, you know, this is.
But is there any evidence that they're effective at recruiting people to the military? Because, I mean, isn't the military, like, hasn't their recruiting goals just been going down, down, down? I mean, they're like, they're letting nerds join the army.
They're letting Lisa Simpson join the army. No, like, there's not. Not that I can tell. And, like, ultimately, like, I think to your point, as much as I don't really care that, like, you know, Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris like Doom and then shot up a school, like, that doesn't compute to me as, like, a correlation. If people play Call of Duty and join the army, again, it's not a correlation. It's much more, like, what's much more interesting to me about it is, like, the amount of leeway one is given. Think about it like this. Like, it's tough to market a show that is anti-cop, right? Like, television that's anti-cop would be really hard to market outside of sort of, like, fringe, like, niche stuff. You have The Shield, but The Shield is winking, right? And something like The Shield might not be as easy to produce today as it was when it was produced, of course, because of cancel culture. Just kidding. but, like, you can produce something called, like, FBI, and you can have 7 spinoffs of FBI all the time, right? Because people just kind of, like, passively accept, like, that's normal. That's, like, typical. That's what we see in media. That's good. Those are, like, you know, uncontrovertibly good things. What I find most interesting about, like, the shift in video games is, like, this understanding after 9/11 that a normal morality is to want to play a first person shooter where you kill, like, America's enemies. Right. It's the same thing we see in action movies. It's the same thing we see in sort of, like, state sanctioned violence in other media. It doesn't mean that it's effective at getting recruiting in, but it sort of changes the way that the media actually operates. Right. So you can have, like, you know, Ronald Reagan or whatever saying he likes Rambo. Whereas he's not going to say that about, I don't know, gun crazy or whatever, right?
Yeah, and, like, I mean, and it's this weird thing where, like, okay, if the violence is shaded or there's a degree of remove through genre, mm-hmm. like in Doom, like, you're blowing away, like, some fucking, like, some demon with, like, robotic spider legs.
Yeah, it's like
these sci-fi things, they don't exist in reality. Right. But whereas if, like, you mentioned, and I think one of the Call of Duty games is just, like, it's just a recreation of some, like, Russian terrorist attack where they blew away, like,
you
do that in the game where you just, like, blow away all these hostages in an airport. And, like, was, like, that was based on a real incident.
You create a psyop. Yeah, exactly. And, like, at the end, like, and it's like, I think what's more affecting to me, and this is sort of, I guess, where it comes to the question of, like, and I don't ever really use the term manufactured consent in my daily life. I find it's, like, not super effective as, like, a concept anymore. It's like, it's sort of like the term gaslighting. Like, people use it all the time. But in this case, like, the idea of manufacturing consent kind of adds up, because anytime they talk to the developers are like, yeah, I had a hard time with that, man. Like, that was a tough choice, but I felt it was necessary to show what really happens on the geopolitical stage. And everyone uncritically accepts this, right? Like, they're just like, the violence was important because it showed us something. Whereas if you look at it, it's like, it's not really that revealing. Like, there's nothing going on. There's no there. There's more there when you're talking about Doom, because it's like, it's imaginative, it's level design, it's sort of like, you know, engaging with the player at a different level. With No Russian, it's just like, it's the twist in a Bond movie, just video game wise.
Well, you bring it up. I mean, like, not to plug our own shit, but
you should always plug your own shit.
The official Chapo Trap House video game, Consent Factory Simulator, will be available on Steam this fall.
It's on my wish list already, for what it's worth. I mean,
it's sort of an unofficial sequel to Dick Sucking Factory.
You guys knocked it out of the park with that one. I was gutted when you said there wouldn't be a Dick Sucking Factory 2, but like, I'm trusting the process now, so it's really good.
All right. Well, I got to move on to from Fortnite to one of Felix's current obsessions. You have a whole chapter on the FromSoft universe, the Dark Souls realm. We're talking Bloodborne. We're talking Demon Souls. But I just want to get you like, how does this relate to like what you describe as one of the most enervating debates currently vexing the video game community? The debate over easy mode. What is this debate? And, you know, like, what are the sides? What are the stakes here? Obviously, the stakes are nothing.
Yeah, but, the stakes are zero.
What are the sides here? What is this argument over easy mode in games?
So, essentially, when you're talking about easy mode in games, right, you're talking about people who grew up, or probably people around our age, who grew up with video games on, like, the Nintendo and then, the earlier consoles, where games were punishingly difficult. And often games are punishingly difficult for very, you know, obvious reasons, such as like the production was not as like rapid fire as it is today. If you can get like 100 hours out of, you know, Chip and Dale's Rescue Rangers, because it's just like brutal to play and like fun, but like impossible, then like, you know, no one's going to complain when the next Nintendo game is delayed, right? But like, what people have taken is this difficulty as a sort of like, a staple of like a fun thing, right? And made it into an identity, which is like ultimately like, you know, the difficulty is the point, right? And with FromSoft games, this becomes like a huge deal, because part of the thematic element of the Souls games particularly is that they're really hard. Like, it's tough to get through it. And like, dying over and over and over again sort of ends up being honestly like an explicit thematic point. Right. It's hard to tell the story in Dark Souls without your character having to die, you know, over and over and over again, because it's sort of like it embeds the thematic for you. but as people point out, like, difficulty is some people argue it's an issue of like ability, and like you're gatekeeping it from some people. I think you would be hard pressed to find a better rejection of that claim than Dia Lucina's in Paste. Like, I mean, she just kind of ripped that apart, and it's not really about ability, like, you know, disability, whatever, is not why video games are difficult. It ends up being basically this question of, should we make games easier so people who just want to play them without any sort of knowledge of what they are make it so that they could do it. And you can think about it like, what's funny is like, it ends up again mirroring a bunch of artistic arguments, harder to do in visual art, but like, think about it in film, right? Like in 1995 or so, when Steven Spielberg brings digital editing to the blockbuster with Jurassic Park, you get this sort of like ongoing critique of like, is it bad to do digital editing because it's easier, right? Or is there an actual artistic difference? Is that can you make a real film doing it this way, or is it some sort of fake film, right? Or take like, go back to Chaucer, right? Like, Chaucer writes in vulgar English in the 13th century. And he's not writing in Latin, and people are like, well, now anyone can understand it. Like, it's not good. Like, this question about access, right? Like, access, not in terms of ability or disability, but in terms of like interest, right? Like, someone on the street picking up a Dark Souls game, should they be able to, or should they not be able to? You know, it's an, as you say, enervating discussion, because it's like pointless, right? Like, the stakes of it are completely non-existent. And ultimately, I think like, for any medium that starts arguing about this, It's the point at which you have to kind of tip the scales and say like, okay, I'm not going to worry about the material process of making this thing anymore as much as I am going to worry about what it's actually saying. Like, it's the point at which, and I don't know if video games are going to be able to do this or not, but it's the point at which you tip from being like, okay, like, I'm making this as a craftsman. And so like, there have to be like six things, in this movie to make it a film. To, okay, this is a film. I'm taking it as a film, regardless of if these six things are here, and I'm going to judge it as such. Like, no one's asking, like, I know, like, everyone's favorite darling of the last, like, 10 years is First Reformed. No one's asking if First Reformed is, like, you know, well, how do they edit it? Like, what are, you know, what are the, how did, what were the, did they film it in, like, you know, this particular film? Is it used based on this particular thing? Did they set it in this particular way? It's understood as, like, an artistic unity that you kind of judge on its own merits. That happens after you hash out the problems of craftsmen and people who think that they have the right to be craftsmen because they've played enough games, right? Or watched enough movies or read enough books.
Well, I mean, the one thing I do appreciate about the Dark Souls universe that you talk about in your chapter on it is that, like, in the universe that the player inhabits, it's very clear that, like, the world that you are sort of born undead into is one that's already died,
right?
And that, like, the lore of, like, how it came to be this way, how the world became to be dead, or where it's going, is parceled out in a very vague and ambiguous way, but it is one nonetheless one in which you are forced to make decisions about what happens in that world. And it's this, right, like, there's a certain existential quality to, like, not really understanding the world that you're in, and then being basically, like, being born and dying, like, infinitely into this world of very, like, a very vague means and, like, vague motives, and, like, but there's just enough to keep you interested. But, like, I like the purposeful, like, ambiguity. And, mm-hmm. and just, like, there's nothing really clear about why any of this is happening, but it's just, like, you have to exist in it and you have to die in it.
Yeah, I mean, there's, like, you know, I think I say this in the book, but, and, like, it's maybe my least confident claim, but, like, there's, like, a Piketty-ian style to Dark Souls with, like, you know, the fail again, or, like, I can't go on, I'll go on. The idea of just, like, continuing for the sake of continuing with no expectation of progress. Like, I would say the most emancipating ending of any Dark Souls games is when you just, like, end the world, right? Like, if you basically get the choice to end the world or have it continue on as it stands. And no, there's no, like, politics baked into it, really. I mean, you can view it as a political decision if you wanted to, but, like, the games themselves don't really encourage that. It's like, highly... It's much more sort of emotive in the sense that, say, like a myth would be, or something like that, where, like, there's big figures who in many cases have existed long before you and have died since. Right. When I had Felix on the podcast last, he and I talked about, like, whether or not this one character was the son of another character, probably for like 15 minutes. Right. Like, it's these questions that are ultimately completely irrelevant to the actual gameplay, and, like, only side, like only, like, vaguely relevant to the actual storyline, that help people obsess over them. And as a result, you get this sort of, like, balance or dialectic, I guess, of the small and the big, right? Where these micro moments, these small characters you meet, then sort of, like, are subsumed into the larger cosmology of the universe. And, like, that in and of itself is an existential problem, where you're just like, oh God, like, nothing I do is going to matter, but ultimately this final act that I'm going to do, I'm set into the play. You're basically in Dark Souls, and I don't make this claim in the book, but it's true. You're basically Fortinbras at the end of Hamlet. Like, you're just brought into the play, and you're like, okay, I'll end it. Like, it's over. Like, I'm going to make the last move here. I'm taking over Denmark, or I'm, like, shutting off the flame or whatever. Like, and your reasons for doing so can never be fully informed. And that's what's so good about those games. And ultimately, like, that's true in the lore, even if the difficulty is lessened. You're never going to know more just by dying a lot.
Well, to round things out here today, I have a Twitter thread that absolutely baffled me earlier in this week. And I was hoping that, Trevor, video game expert, you could help unpack what's really going on here.
Yeah, I'm going to pull it up.
Yeah, this is by a gentleman. I'm just going to read you their Twitter bio. It says here, protecting what is mine, PhD student in philosophy and history, true classical liberal, center left, pro beauty, pro freedom, anti bullying, anti feminism, anti SJW. Okay. And then if you actually click through their thread, it's mostly just retweets of anime girls. So, I mean, it did advertise itself as being pro beauty. So, but let's just get into it. It says here, I was thinking about why so many in the radical left participate in speed running. The reason is the left's lack of work ethic, go fast rather than do it right. And in a Petersonian sense, he means Jordan Peterson, in a Jordan Petersonian sense, to elevate alternative sexual archetypes are in the marketplace, i.e. fastest Mario. Okay, that's the first tweet. And I just, okay, where do you want to begin? So speed running. The speed running, for those who are not aware, it's like you get on Twitch, you do a YouTube, and it's like, how do you complete either a level of a video game or the entire video game itself as fast as possible using certain tricks, shortcuts? Like, it's just, you're not trying to defeat every enemy. You're just trying to, like, on just pure time, literally run through an entire video game as fast as possible.
Right. Now, it's its own sort of way of playing the game. Like, it ignores any other way of, like, structuring it. There's a great video, if anyone's interested in it, by Carl Jobst about speedrunning the first Doom level, which is like a 20 minute video about an 8 second run, and it's amazing. It's like perfect. But it's all about, like, okay, so, like, you figure out that if you cut this corner at exactly the right time, you can shave a tenth of a second off. It's basically just like it's obsessive pruning.
Yeah, I mean, it seems, but it says, like, the reason is the left's lack of work ethic. But I mean, like, that seems odd to me, because, like, to speed run with any real talent, or to actually, like, break a record, it seems insanely difficult.
You have to be
fucking
so
mind-breakingly, like, mind-breakingly fucking it's strenuous.
It's like unbelievable.
You know, it's like playing a piano concerto. Like, if you miss one fucking key, like, you're gonna, the whole thing's fucking blown, no matter how many hours you've invested into it.
Yeah, and you see, like, people screw up speed runs. I mean, if you ever watch any of them, I'm not an avid consumer of it, but, like, I watch it when I can, and, like, if you watch, you'll see people in, like, 2 hours in, they're like approaching a world record, and they'll miss a jump, and they'll be like, well, I guess that's it. Like, I guess I'm not going to do it. It's like, jeez.
And this idea of, like, a lack of work ethic, go fast rather than do it right, seems odd to me, because in video games, there is no real way to do it right. If
Correct.
You beat the game, you beat the game. It doesn't matter how many fucking, like, shortcuts you took to get there. I mean, like, and especially when, in this case, the shortcuts make playing the game actually vastly more difficult.
Right.
But when it gets into this, to elevate sexual archetypes in the marketplace, i.e. fastest Mario.
I read this thread so many times, just trying to figure out if it was a joke, because the idea of a sexual archetype called fastest Mario is like like the funniest sort of like reference to Mario I've seen in a very long time. Like, the whole, like, Waluigi, Year of Luigi thing made the whole Mario stuff very unfunny to me. And then fastest Mario as a sexual archetype, like, brought it all back. It was like, it was the Renaissance for me.
It says here, obviously there are exceptions to this, and some people more in the center or right also speedrun. However, they are more than sufficient to prove the rule rather than contrast it. Consider how woke GDQ has been almost since the very beginning. Your eyes will start to open. Returning to the topic of the work ethic, a speedrunner may well spend hours a day at their craft, but this is ultimately a meaningless exercise, since they will ultimately accomplish exactly what is done in less collective time by a casual player. This is thus a waste of effort on behalf of the speedrunner. Put more simply, they are spending their work effort on something that someone else has already done and done in a way deemed correct by the creator of the artwork. Why do they do this? The answer is quite obvious if you think about it. The goal is the illusion of speed and the desire, subconscious in parentheses, to promote radical leftist borderline communist ideals of how easy work is. Everyone always say that speedruns look easy. That is part of the aesthetic. Think about the phrase fully automated luxury communism in the context of speedrunning, and I strongly suspect that things will start to click in your mind. Is anything clicking in your minds yet?
No. I one thing that's clicking in my mind is that this guy really is, like, has ideas about what counts as work that very much baffle me. Like, I don't know if any speedrunner would tell you what they're doing is labor.
And I mean, it's also like speedrunning is working in the wrong way. It's working fast rather than smart. But, like, in no point is playing video games work.
No,
it's not labor in any sense.
No, absolutely not. And, like, this was something that came up. I won't put the person on blast here, but there was someone who was who sort of made a comparison between making a 10-hour video about video games and stocking supermarket shelves, right? And said, like, making the video was so much harder than stocking supermarket shelves. And, like, it got a ton of blowback, necessarily, because that's a crazy thing to say. But, like, in part, I think this, like, the blowback comes from the fact that, like, no one is thinking that your video on, like, you know, Mario or your playthrough of Mario or whatever is like productive labor. Even the people producing it, like, why would you assume it's productive labor? It's in the same way that, like, watching a movie is not productive labor. It doesn't have
but
to be.
But if you slow are down, putting
slow down,
your
slow down.
If you're putting your speed run on YouTube and enough people watch it that you get ad revenue, does that make it labor?
Well,
I mean, can't knock the hustle. If you're getting paid,
It is a hustle. It's a hustle. I don't know. Like, I think, do you, so here's the question, and I'll throw it back to you. Like, do you think, and we both make one, so, like, this is not throwing any shade at you at all or throwing any rocks in my own glass house. Is making a podcast labor?
Certainly doesn't feel like it.
Well, yeah, that's why people want to do it, because it's work that is not work.
Right. But it's productive of money, right? Which I think, like, on some level, there's an elision that's happening a lot in culture where we assume something that's productive of money counts as labor, which maybe it does. But I think, like,
why the future really does lie with Grimes's vision of a video game based UBI. Everybody made fun of her for saying that, but I think that honestly does make sense as the way to do it, because
it's very Keynesian.
Because, yeah, you can't just give the because people say, oh, give people money. They'll go crazy.
As
give people money that they gain through video gaming. Like, give them money based on the grinding that they would do in a video game that keeps them occupied and keeps a roof over their head and keeps them consuming.
So Grimes's idea is that, like, a UBI would be administered, and, like, your UBI check at the end of the month would be based on, like, you know, the stats you've just grinded out in a video game.
I think the third leg of the stool is the blockchain, and the idea is that the work that you're doing with the video game, it's not just to show you're doing work. It's doing the function that, like, the Bitcoin mining rigs are doing right now. So you're authenticating the blockchain through your participation in the video games, thus creating the coins that you can then get as your UBI.
But so, I mean, this is, like, the whole thing, though, right? Where, like, if we're talking about blockchain as a way of creating real value, right? And I know that, like, I'm not arguing with you about this. Like, the idea of value has to be, like, then questioned, right? Like, what do we mean then? Like, what is production? What is value? What is labor? And like, I think at a certain point when you're reading a thread like this, it shows that the person hasn't ever thought about that. Like, the idea of, does it put money into my bank account? Then it's labor or work. Like, maybe that's true, but then you also have to, like, it's not classical labor. It's not classical work. It's not classical value, right? It's not classical money. You have to start, like, really disconnecting those things from what you understand them as.
Now, I'm just if this guy's a fake post, I'm just looking at his account here, and it seems like he has really committed to the bit. But I'll just go on here. It says here, now, as to the sexual archetype model and speedrunning generally, if any of you have any passing familiarity with Jordan Peterson's broader oeuvre and of Jungian psychology,
which of course
you likely already know where I'm going with this. However, I will say for the uninitiated, keep this passage from Maps of Meaning in mind. The archetypal son continually reconstructs defined territory as a consequence of the assimilation of the unknown, as a consequence of incestuous, that is, sexual, read creative union with the great mother. In other words, there is a connection between sexuality and creativity that we see throughout time, as Peterson points out in other examples. In the sexual marketplace, which archetypes are simultaneously deemed the most creative and valued the highest? The answer is obviously entrepreneurs like Elon Musk and others. Given that we evolved and each thing we do must have an evolutionary purpose or cause, what archetype is the speedrunner engaged in? Who is accomplishing nothing new? They are aiming to make a new sexual archetype based upon speed rather than doing things right, and refuse ownership of what few innovations they can provide to their own scene, denying creativity within their very own sexual archetype. This is necessarily leftist. The obvious protest to this would be the glitchless 100% run, which
it's
in many ways
protest,
does aim to play the game as intended, but seems to simply add the element of speed to the equation. This objection is ultimately meaningless when one considers how long a game is intended to be played. I mean, like, I'm reading words here, but, like, there's no talk about maps. I need a map of meaning for this fucking thread here.
Yeah. So, like, I think, like, this goes right into what Matt was saying about, like, you know, like the blockchain being part of the video game that you play to do UBI, and everyone makes fun of it. But in fact, like, this is something that could plausibly like work for a lot of people in the world. Like, ultimately, like, this guy is doing the Jordan Peterson thing of like doing the very, you know, trying to be like Thomas Carlyle or something like that, like some sort of classic man of letters or something. And it does the thing where he says, like, you know, everything we do has to be based on evolution, which, like, that can't possibly be right. Like, at this point in human existence, like, it's like, can't possibly.
Well, yeah, I mean, true. But it's a meaningless context. It's a meaningless concept with conscious beings. I mean, right. We are like, evolution has been transcended by human civilization.
Yeah, I can do whatever I want. It doesn't my survival's guaranteed in a certain way.
Like, we've redefined the natural world and natural feedbacks, and pretend, and like, if you want everything to be about evolution, then you have to dissolve all of those social bonds completely so that nature can actually impact things, which it does not do right now.
Correct. And I think the other thing, like, where he talks about, like, where he does the thing with the 100% glitchless run, which for the interest of giving Will a map, that is like, basically the idea there is you're doing everything in the game without employing any sort of
like zero damage, like zero hits.
Yeah, or like you know, like there's ways of beating N64 games that rely on the fact that someone found a glitch that saves you, you know, 13 minutes or something like that, right? You say, like, I'm not using that, I'm going to use the other stuff. And they're two different like categories of speedrun. It's pretty interesting. But the funny thing about this, right, where he says, like, it's ultimately meaningless when one considers how long a game is intended to be played, even when under there is still time and effort wasted for no other reason than the ones I've proposed above, which is like, the idea here is like that time and effort isn't wasted when you're playing it the first time through.
Like, yeah,
I'm playing Mario and like, this is very useful time for me, right? Like, it can be cathartic. It can be interesting. It can like give you something. It can give you nothing. It can make you zone out, right? That is literally the exact same thing speedrunning does. And so like this view of the world, right? Like whether or not it's a fake post or not, it does represent this real understanding of the world that everything one does has to be boiled down into like, what am I doing to, you know, build my evolutionary grind to become like pheromonally perfect for the ladies, right? Like how can I pass on my seed when I need to play Silent Hill two times? Like it's a bizarre thing. And like, I think, brought to maybe its most like absurd instance that I've seen here.
Bringing my partner to triple digit orgasm, speed run. I mean, shit. I mean, if you get to the end of the game, it doesn't matter how long it took you to do it. You
it
know,
also does, this is also
mission
this is also
accomplished.
This is also the evolution of the never rewatch movies guy, right? Like never rewatch movies, never reread a book. Because it's a waste of time because you've done it once already, right? Like, not even to say, like, if you play through a video game twice. Like, let's even take, like, a game that is, like, undeniably sort of, like, you know, not meaningful from its plot perspective. Like, the first Mario. You can play through it once, and then maybe you're just like, oh, that was fun. I'd like to do that again. Or, like, I'd like to do it better. Or I want to revisit it, right? Those are all perfectly valid reasons to, like, engage with culture. And, like,
you know how many times I had to see the original Mission Impossible movie to understand what was going on in it?
it's that and Stalker, the Tartakovsky Stalker. Those are the two that are the hardest to understand in cinema to understand.
They were trying to find the knock list in the stalking zone. At least as I understand it. At the end here it says, by now I am sure I have bothered a number of you and rustled quite a few of your feathers. I'm not saying that speedrunning is bad, but rather that thinking about the topic philosophically, that there are dangerous elements within it. I mean, if you think about anything philosophically, I think you can discover dangerous elements.
Tweeting. How about that? posting on a social media site.
Doing if this person actually is a PhD student in philosophy and history and they did a 15 tweet thread, like I would, if I could find that as their advisor, I would say, here's a dangerous thing that you're doing, not finishing your coursework. Shouldn't you be writing your dissertation instead of this 14 tweet thread about like video games and the left? Tell me more about Husserl.
Oh, yeah, there's the speed running thread for you. We didn't get a chance to talk about Metal Gear Solid, but we got to wrap it up for today. Trevor Strunk, the book is Story Mode. If people would like to purchase or read Story Mode, where should they go?
They can go anywhere. You could go to the Evil Empire and buy it off of Amazon. I know that's not the most popular way to do it, but if you're out of the country,
it's literally the most popular way to do it.
Well, yeah, among the 70 people we always hear from, it's not the most popular way to do it. You know, I'm sure, like, you know, you will ruffle the feathers of a few folks. But if you're out of the country of the United States, it is the best way to get it, I find. That's the easiest way to get it via Amazon. But it's also available on all the other things. You can order it from your local bookstore. You can ask your library to get it if you'd rather do that. You can get it on bookshop.org or any of those places. Just Google Story Mode Strunk or Story Mode Video Games. I think, like, typically, if you just look up Story Mode, there's a Minecraft book before it, and then it's my book. So do buy the Minecraft book, but also buy my book too. But yeah, no, it's everywhere. And it ships on the 15th, so you'll get it probably by like March or so, based on how shipping goes. Just kidding. It should probably be there by the end of November.
Trevor Strunk, the book is Story Mode. The podcast is No Cartridge. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining us this week.
Absolutely. Read the Metal Gear chapter. You'll know what Felix is talking about. Will is absolutely correct.
Cheers, guys. Until next time. Bye-bye.